Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to our final seminar. I hope you're able to hang around. If you'd like to discuss some aspects of this that we may not have covered or you'd like to go into in a little bit more depth at the top of the hour, anything now that you'd like to add or ask or highlight as we go into our final seminar looking at the last two steps of understanding a money story. Anything you want to add or ask or just say at this point, anyone?
Good evening.
I'm sorry,
This is Enyla Bernita. How are you?
Great, hey. How are you? Go ahead, please. Thanks.
I thought you, Dr. Cruz. Sorry. I'm just doing a recap on, you know, it's definitely a lot to take in. I can't believe the 4 weeks are now over after today. So I had a couple of questions. One, will the, I think you said the recording should be on for a year, or at least if it's on for the next 30 days, it'll be great, too.
Yeah, it'll be on at least the rest of the year, and I'll be sure that CTA does that so that you'll have access to it.
Okay. Yeah, it's just like, you know, sometimes someone says, oh, you read the Bible, you get a new new word or new some revelation. But just had a question about when you talk about belief drives behavior drives performance. So that and how, you know, the authorship part of that money story with those beliefs and identities and things like that. It's pretty enlightening. I just wanted to just ask, if there's a possibility to delve a little bit more into that, how the belief becomes the performance, you know, after you drive the behavior toward it.
Okay. That's a fundamental equation. I'm glad you asked about it because I want to give some examples of some beliefs that you may not hear but may be there or it may be more conscious than your client would want to know. So whatever we believe is an anatomical reality in our brains. So like facts and information, you don't just change a belief by offering somebody a better one and think it's going to override the belief that's there, because the belief is the answer that someone will have to a question. Yeah, but how do you really know? Or what do you really think? They're going to tell you their belief, and their belief is what they're going to operate on. And here are some beliefs, for example, about money that someone may not be conscious of, or they may be somewhat conscious of, but either way, they're the beliefs that will begin to write the behavior, because the beliefs are the software that determine then how things are perceived and processed, the behavior, and then that's going to determine the process, or the performance rather. So listen to how these beliefs are going to shape someone's approach. These are all beliefs about money that a client may become aware of. I'm not supposed to have it. I'm not supposed to really spend it. If I happen to have money, I'm supposed to act like I don't. If I spend on myself, I'm selfish. If I make or spend significant money, I need to keep it secret. If I really have money, I can't let myself or anyone else know how much I have. It's a taboo passion, yet one I have to handle daily. So think about the example that I gave earlier also as another area of approach to this. We talked about if two partners in a couple, you're doing couples coaching, one partner has the meaning of money, the core meaning of money as freedom. The other partner, money means to them security. So the person who money means freedom, they're going to want to spend and enjoy and express what money means because that brings freedom and enjoyment. The other, the enjoyment is the security that accumulates with money. So they have a very different model. They're wired very differently. So they will need to look at navigating and negotiating a common story that they'll both buy into that you as the coach can be catalyst for. So that's just a simple example. Not uncommon, by the way, but it may oversimplify it for that purpose because it may not be quite as clear. But one thing that I do with almost every new client is to ask that client to do two exercises that will take maybe 10 or 15 minutes total, a needs and ideals exercise. And I send them that exercise, and they pick their top three needs and their top three ideals, because that is going to be important for both of us to be aware of as we look at understanding what they're doing and creating a strategy and goals so that their needs and ideals are in the flow and taken into account with their strategies and goals so that all of them is going in the same direction. So that's helpful for both of us to know because we can then align what we look at and what we do, because needs and ideals both are at the core of identity. And we're going to be talking about that specifically this seminar in step seven. So we'll come back to that. So for right now, does that make a little more sense in terms of that equation and your question?
Absolutely. It makes me think about when you made the comment about the need, the freedom versus security, and I may have titled it from the needs versus the wants, how we typically have a want for something, but to justify the spending, we say that we need it. So,
yeah. You can never get enough of what you don't need, and that can lead to addiction. And getting what you want may be satisfying, but it also leads to wanting more. And then there's the what's called the hedonic treadmill. When someone gets to a certain income level, they tend to enjoy and spend at that level, and they then may need more to keep the same level of enjoyment. It takes more to sustain the same level of experience and enjoyment because we get habituated to it. We become acclimated to it and accustomed to it, so it takes more. That's why the idea of more is not a goal, and it may be important to recognize with someone what their specific goals are, what enough is, so that they'll know when they get there.
Very true.
Thanks very much. Other thoughts or questions or comments at this point? Well, we'll go back to the open mic at the end for any discussion or questions you have. Be sure and jot them down, and we'll come back to them. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode now and talk about our final two steps. Okay, the last two steps, step six, is author new experiences. In other words, put this into action. We trust our stories. They're our reality. If our stories and our behaviors don't fit, we experience disharmony. So we have to change one or the other to restore harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we just change the way we see reality. Now, we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it will disallow you from finishing early. If your story is you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So let's now look and reflect on this as a coach. These are not plays you run in or questions you ask of your client, but these are for you, for your toolbox, your observational developmental capacity. Listen to this in terms of what you've observed with your clients and what you'll be doing with your clients to be a catalyst for change. So here are some dynamics of change. First, the idea of change will create excitement. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, anxiety or trepidation. Then, expansion. And then, finally, mastery. Now, there are a couple of additional aspects of experiencing change that can seem paradoxical. First, every step forward means relinquishing a past position. Someone must mourn. They must say goodbye, emotionally as well as practically, to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story. This is a process. It's a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it, change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern or behavior or a hope that by getting the old story just right or doing it better, it's going to work finally. No matter how maladaptive, the old story still has to be mourned. And the second, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem, a kind of narcissistic injury, because this carefully crafted old story has aspects of identity embedded, and you recognize you can replace it with something better. Maybe that you could have been doing it all along, so you have to say goodbye to what was and what never was in order to fully engage the present. Sometimes saying goodbye to what never was is harder than what was, even traumatically so, because you give up the hope of getting it right in the past in order to move to the present. So here are six components, as I see it, in this dynamic of change. Now, again, these are not headlines. You won't see these signs that you can label. These are just to think about yourself as internal conceptual markers. The myth that there is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing's perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. That's called adulthood. The development, the recognition that no one's going to take care of it for you. Another thing that we also scientifically call adulthood. The growth to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation. The happy, sad experience combined that results. Happy about the autonomy and the effectiveness of moving ahead, of not constructing an obstacle, but sad about mourning an old story. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend, even if it didn't work as well. So, here are some ABCs of financial mistakes. Now, there are 25 or 26 listed in your outline, but I just want to highlight a couple in each of the categories, maybe some of the more common ones to give you an idea maybe of how to listen for these in your clients. This is simply a way of organizing maybe money issues, mistakes, the storylines that don't work, basically, to get a better understanding. The compromised money behaviors and financial decisions I'll put into four categories, the ABCs, affect, feeling, behavior, cognition, thinking, or social. Most of these are all in your workbook along with their remedies, but and we've discussed some vignettes and examples, but I want to highlight a couple in each category. First, the affect bias, the emotional biases. One is nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at difficult times. Nostalgia remembers things not as they were, but as we wish them to be. Airbrushed memories backlit by idealization. Nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. Has anyone gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go on, or less popular in memory replays? marketing taps into those nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate with idealized memory than to create a new product identification. So the nostalgic trigger is overlaid with new information, a new association. This coupling uses nostalgia to influence current choice. Arnold Palmer and that old tractor, remember that commercial? Two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. Another, invincibility bias. The seemingly inextinguishable, inexhaustible sense of immortality that we all had when we were young. There are still whispers in adulthood. 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. No, that's not true, even here in Texas. 75% believe they're healthier than average. And remember the tech rally investors in the late 1990s? So here are a couple of examples of behavioral biases. A transference fallacy. In psychoanalysis, the tendency to revive feelings and experiences from a past context to a current one is considered a type of transference. Basically, it's simply using old software to process a present experience in software that's biased or outdated. A simple example. Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline when Hewlett-Packard collapsed half of its value that same day. Totally unrelated, except in the minds of investors, and viable in its own right. It gained it back, but it was that effect. A spending justification is a behavior bias. Creating a just cause to spend, justifying it. Someone takes money from retirement savings to spend with the justification of an immediate need being greater than an abstract need in the future of retirement. So the coaching question for this internal bargaining that says, I'll repay it next check or next month, is how will you actually repay it? Or it may be vaguely dismissed with a vow to return the money at some future point. Neither is a plan. One more example, a status quo bias, a resistance to leaving a comfort zone. Status quo bias. The status quo bias is another name for inertia. This default option is to stay in the current experience, to not change. Here's an example. Marketers know that when they give a free trial of 3 months, it's called a forced free trial when you don't ask for it, because you sign up for a free trial, but then you give your credit card number at the beginning, and the fourth month they begin charging it unless you unsubscribe. They know that people tend to stay with the familiar and get inertia, and people who sign up, 75 to 80% of the initial free subscribers do not unsubscribe. They stick with their default choices. And this is true, for example, with magazine subscriptions. And the other follow-up was that almost 70% of people did not read the magazines they did not unsubscribe for. And remember, we talked about, in a positive way, one single good decision that can become automatic, set up as automatic, to withdraw an amount of money the first of every month from your checking to automatically place it in your retirement fund. One good decision. A couple of examples of cognitive biases. Here's one that it's called diagnosis bias. Once we label a person or a situation, we then seek data to confirm it more vigorously and become more blind to evidence that contradicts it. Here's an example. Two economists, Barry Staw and Ha Huang, studied skill categories and stats of new NBA players. They distilled these stats into specific skill measuring categories, scoring, quickness, toughness. They looked at all the variables then that determine playing time in games over the next 5 years. Skill categories, players' performance, injury or trade. There was one variable that had greater impact than any of these actual performance data. It was the player's draft selection order. In fact, draft order was more highly correlated with playing time through the first 5 years in the NBA, which is as long as they studied it. So even though skill and performance determines a draft order, once picked, coaches and managers should only be interested in players' performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number's history and performance is everything. Not so, says diagnosis bias. Now, think about this is what we do every day in coaching. This is called framing. Once we frame something, then that boots up a particular mindset that processes all the remainder of the conversation. For example, we've talked before, and I'll be redundant to give you some sense of consistency with some new things added. When our brains don't know the difference between anxiety and excitement. If we label it as anxiety, that boots up a mindset of caution, of trust, of looking at protection of oneself. So danger, better head for cover. If instead you frame it as opportunity, as challenge, as excitement, then you look for possibilities to move ahead in a stepwise way so that it can actualize the potential. Same stimulation, same activation of the same part of the brain, how you label it determines how you proceed. And that's exactly what we do in coaching. Someone begins with, well, let me tell you about this problem. So we may interrupt to say, what's the opportunity here? Because they've got the problem down. You know, 14 minutes later, they're winding down to a story they know very, very well, and it hasn't helped them a bit. Social biases, the last category. Affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of things we like and overestimate the risk of things we're unfamiliar with or don't like foreign enemies or an out-of-favor investment. Let's say you lose $20 betting a favorite in the Super Bowl. Well, that's unlucky. If you lose $500 betting your alma mater will win their game even though they have the worst record in the conference, that's affinity bias. Another, loss aversion. Selling a loser admits defeat. We tend to avoid pain. There's about twice as much pain with losing $100 as there is a good feeling or pleasure in gaining $100. And these are brain measurements. So these are things, and in fact, here's an example of that. Harry Markowitz won a Nobel Prize in economics for the mathematical breakthrough showing how to calculate trade-off between risk and return in portfolio selection of stocks. He admitted, though, that he couldn't apply or didn't apply it to his own portfolio. He said, I visualized my grief if the stock market went up and I wasn't in it, or if it went way down and I was completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret. So he was not even immune. Now, look when you can at the other ABCs of financial fallacies, money mistakes. I think there are 26 or so in those four categories in your outline. So I'd rather focus with you now at the most frequent mistakes in writing a new money story. And these are things that you can reflect on and listen for in your co-creation with clients. First, not knowing that you don't know. So how can people know they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we're mistaken. So to know to ask is half the answer. This is the application of the growth mindset in coaching that we want to stimulate in ourselves and co-creatively with our clients, to look at possibilities, at things that can be done, can be learned. Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this may be a correct strategy, but it can also stop us from considering other right answers, other things that may be even more effective. So we may need to ask first ourselves, and then what? What else? What are other possibilities? So I'm going to introduce number three with this brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, though, planned their strategy, created a system, and then decided they would jump off. How many were left? Yeah, five were left because they planned and decided. They didn't commit to act and act. Number three is procrastination. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We know the abstract notion of finiteness and there is no immortality, but we may have little sense of urgency that can contribute to a lack of focus. Here's an illustration. When the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in that final 2 minutes than they did the previous 28. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to focus on and accomplish goals, actually focuses concentration and increases effort. In our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is an abstraction, something we acknowledge but seem not to internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. Four, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths and limitations, your biorhythms, biological cycles, when you perform best, and creating a systematic way to do deliberate practice to perform at your best, whether that's coaching, an artistic, a business, or athletic endeavor, the same principles of deliberate practice. Know how to enter and exit various states of mind and which works best for a particular task. The example I gave before, writing and editing, two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at two different times. Cluster activities that require the same state of mind. This is very useful in coaching those who have attention challenges, that they need to really manage their focus and attention as a precious resource and utilize it optimally. Identify what enhances your energy, anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer, whatever it is individually. Identify what depletes your energy, toxic people or situations, too much of a focus and not choosing one thing, negative mindset, any other lack of focus. Five, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them, since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty adds to decision paralysis. And this is often what we can see in coaching. What looks like resistance may simply be a lack of clarity about what the next step is. So, does someone have a plan, and are they sticking to it? They don't need to be motivated. They don't need to be comfortable. They just need a plan and stick to it. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear. Eating a healthier diet, it's vague and abstract. The possibilities of eat healthier, save for the future, are limitless. Where to begin? Whenever you want to change, create a system, a map. 6, too many choices. Studies have shown how too many choices can debilitate rather than liberate, and someone retreats to a default mode of not making a choice. Here's an initial and classic study in decision paralysis. It was done at a gourmet, you probably have heard about this, done at a gourmet grocery store on alternate weekends. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. On the alternate weekends, there were 24 jams available for tasting. For each of these weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. So, with the larger display of jams, 24 to taste, it attracted more potential customers. In most cases, people tasted a larger number of jams. When 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% of people purchased. When 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% purchased. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing. I remember in college getting to the academic center, spreading out all my books and looking at all the things that I had to do and all the possibilities, and promptly took a nap. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's the resilience to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion, can cut through the fog like a beacon in the night. One extra degree of effort in business and life can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingseagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish the book himself and sell it out of the trunk of his car. It had a really unlikely title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. And it won't begin with comfort and confidence. Lord Eliot put it really simply, perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. So, success is never final. Don't get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating. Test ideas out. Revise them. Make it your story, told with your voice. Here's what Ross Perot, a fellow Texan, said. Most people give up when they're about to achieve success. They quit on the 1-yard line. And number 8, not following success trails. Here's a personal story. When I did my transition from practicing and teaching psychiatry psychoanalysis to mentor coaching, my good buddy, Art, knew what I was doing, and when I completed my professional coach training, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. A few years earlier, he had left IBM as a very senior executive to go out on his own. People were wondering why he was going out. He was a young guy at the time. He was going out on his own to form his own consulting firm. He said, Dave, this is what I did. I took 5 people to lunch or dinner who did what I was doing, or had done what I planned to do, and picked their brains. He said, I would recommend the same for you. You can count me as number 1. You just got 4 to go. It worked significantly well for him. Business people whose names you would immediately recognize have worked with him for substantial picking fees. So create a support team. Maybe construct an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor, join a mastermind group. 9, believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. Now, there doesn't have to be a split between spirituality and money. Spirituality and profitability can be very compatible. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent and dedication have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? It's their belief and not their art that creates that difficulty. Abundance, wealth, spirituality, these are all synonyms. The antonyms, suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. And remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches. Rich and spiritual are synonyms. You will improve your health by creating less stress, as stress causes the body to be less healthy. You'll create an attitude and an experience of abundance, which will also enhance wellness. There's a detailed outline in your workbook about visualization and affirmation. And this is the exercise. I'm not going to go through it with you just because of time, because I want to discuss some other things, and you'll see it in there. But basically, what visualization does is to rewire your brain. When someone, with a client, for example, can visualize a successful outcome and all of the experience associated with it, and does that repeatedly, they're creating a future vision, a future memory to live into. And then the strategy to get there is what you can work at with them. And creating the vision can often be a way, especially if they have a concern or a fear of success, they're creating the vision of successful achievement. So it's a matter of creating a strategy to back into it, and affirmations are part of the software that affirms and supports the vision. So this is what having a vision will do. It can give you creative ideas. It can help you see things you haven't seen before. And it can create a motivating way to achieve that image that you see. So when you program your unconscious and create a future memory to live into, your brain can't tell who conjured it. You are reality. The more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. Now, here's a key. You don't make the brain changes permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. Otherwise, it doesn't register or it gets extruded as noise. This may be why 95% of people who diet gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image. So the three key elements here are repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision need to be renewed and repeated regularly. Secondly, be very specific about the experience, the entire experience of achieving the goal. And then consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be metabolized as part of yourself. And remember, we talked about initially, your identity is the most powerful thing in the human psyche. You'll always return to it. So this is why any change that you initiate for yourself or with your client needs to be incorporated as part of an operating model, transformed into a part of how and who you see yourself to be, to make it permanent. We're going to move to that that part of the fourth step is about programming new identity, and this is what is so important to help your client recognize and self-reflect what they're doing and how they're doing things that are differently, that are different than what they know and have done before. And you can also help them reframe this discomfort of doing something new and different as a signpost of being in new territory, validation that they're doing something new and different. It's not the intuition of this is not right, or their gut telling them this is the wrong thing for me. Those have a place, but this discomfort is simply the register of the error detection mechanism, the register of creating a new pathway in a new experience that has not been previously experienced. You cannot be totally comfortable about that because you've never been there before. This is what's important. I want to come back to a more vivid example of that maybe in our discussion if we have time. But this final step, the programming new identity, is what we do as coaches with someone to recognize and get and help them reflect on the different experience and to acknowledge how they're doing it differently this time, how they're reflecting, how they're proceeding in a different way, to look at the progress that they've made of what they are doing right now compared to just a month or two or 4 or 5 months ago, and to acknowledge that process, to develop that self-reflective capacity themselves. You know, I mentioned a couple of studies in the two journals that I referenced about the most recognized success factor in executives of all kinds of variables, including various expertises, areas of expertise in their industry or specialty, is the development of self-awareness and self-regulation. They have come to recognize them. That's exactly why we are empathically resonant with our clients, to help them develop self-empathy, to help them reflect on the process of a growth mindset, to look at what they do and the impact of it, to see what works and what doesn't work. So here's an overview of these 7 steps. So we've examined a money story as reality, and money is reality and metaphor, the path as well as the possession, and the power we give to it and its own power. We've taken a journey to illuminate and ultimately change your money story with these 7 steps. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map changes, author new experiences, and then program new identity. So in these 7 steps, we've articulated how money can create for us, how we create a story that we can come to see the characteristics, what works and what doesn't, how some money issues are really about money, and how a bunch of other things, most of the time, hitchhike on money, but how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These basic steps can deconstruct how you write your money story and live it. They are building blocks to revise a money story or simply write a new one. So let's review some essentials of engineering effectiveness in this area. 1, make changes tangible and concrete. This is part of creating a system, a map. A map tells you, again, where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way, what's detour and what's distraction. You construct a map to know how you can proceed. This is the system that we engage in coaching. 2, as part of that, make progress measurable. demystify the journey, a specific destination with a tangible focus on the next step. So we're looking at a microsystem here, the next step. We're also looking at a larger map of a goal for the week, and then a goal maybe in the wide-angle view for the coaching engagement itself. 3, make progress visible. For example, small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible with celebration of each small victory, ultimately so the client does that himself or herself. 4, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global. Some is not a number, soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. So in one way of thinking about it, all you ever need to do is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to immediate steps of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. The best example of shrinking a task to a tangible next step is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action and commitment. A small target leads to small victories. The cumulative experience is effectiveness and mastery. So, in another sense, what we've just done is to adopt the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change, and then review the effect of that change. The scientific method is a challenge. To create a mindset of inquiry can generate discomfort in and of itself, but also catalyzes growth. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated specifically where the self resides in the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that lights up when people self-reflect, they make assessments and judgments about themselves, and they think of some aspect of their identity. Neuroeconomics labs have come to recognize this. They can hook up an fMRI of subjects and offer 10 different items for purchase. They can predict with way in the 90% of accuracy what item someone will choose to purchase, because when they look at the item that they're going to purchase, that is most resonant with their identity. They purchase with what they identify, and that's something that is consistent and it's even predictable. A recent study found something I think also really important. The more clearly and fully you can picture your future self, the more money you'll save for the future. Emily Pronin at Princeton did this for people who could actually picture their future self into their 80s. They saved money at almost 3 times the rate of people who could not or did not predict or imagine their future self. Now, there have been a couple of labs, particularly on the West Coast, that have done visual imagery and computer progression, for example, to show what someone will look like in 10 and 20 and 30 years if they do smoke, if they don't, if they exercise, if they don't, if they have a good diet, if they don't. This enhances participation and healthy habits at 3 to 4 times the normal rate of those who do not participate in these studies. So being able to look a bit into the future means you're going to plan for it. A review of some guidelines now. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it, to plan it, map it, and tell it initiates its creation. This is why we put something in the output channel, because it not only completes the story cycle in the brain, but it means we're more poised for action. We remember it better, and we're more likely to act on it. Whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is a response to the story you're telling yourself, not all of which, most of which, may not be conscious. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell the story so that it shifts your feeling and thinking as you're telling, so that it makes it conscious. This means that responses from others are not in this equation of creation. This is between you and you. It does not depend on how someone else responds to you once you're at the level of adulthood. This new telling has to be in alignment with who you are, your identity, especially your needs and ideals, in order to have a complete energy field and a full, purposeful direction of that field going forward. When you practice the story that resonates with who you are, your full energy and power become activated. All of you is going in the same direction. When that occurs, know the direction you're going and the goal and strategies of that pathway. And finally, know that you could keep telling and living a better story, no matter how good your story is now. The universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. So here's a final story, and a final quote. The final story. For tens of thousands of years before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, and illuminated the future. Story allowed us to connect with each other's humanity in the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way humans communicate. Story gives birth to possibility. Stories are a way that we can resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. Now, here's a final quote. This may be the turning point your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now, the time you leapt over the abyss to the other side of the Great Divide and began your life in earnest. On the other hand, this moment of truth may end up being nothing more than a brief awakening when you glimpse what's possible on the other side of the Great Divide, but tell yourself, nah, that's way too far to jump. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content talking about what delicious cookies you used to bake or what your favorite sports team was. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. We're in conversation mode now. If you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in any thoughts, questions, or just any observations, anything else that might be helpful for us to talk about.
Dave, this is Julie. I have a question for you. The most frequent mistakes, are those in the workbook?
Yes. Those are in the outline. There are two things you have. One is the outline of each of the four seminars. Those are in the outline rather than the workbook. But they're there, yes. And the recording is up if you want to re-listen to it in more detail than just the summary part.
Okay. really resonated tonight when you talked about the step forward as a mourning for an old step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
That's deeply resonant with me, yes. But yeah, I noticed a lot of things in the workbook about, you know, people who take too many chances. I would be quite the opposite. I'm definitely struggling with the, I'm the one who wrote about the feeling of confidence to move forward, and that's not how it works.
Yeah, yeah.
So, looking at, the way, you know, the ways to deal with that and mourning for an old step is interesting, even though the old steps were really painful. So, I mean, that's fascinating when you talk about, you know, just the fear of change.
Yeah, you know, one place that I saw this consistently was in my former life. I began one of the couple of largest eating disorder treatment programs in the country, multidisciplinary treatment team. So I saw people from all over. And for the example I want to use here is young women who had bulimia. At that time, there wasn't much known about bulimia. It was kind of a secret issue because nobody wanted to talk about it. They were so embarrassed and ashamed. And each person, each young woman who had bulimia recognized how difficult it was to give, even though it had been painful, it limiting and created all kinds of problems, yet at a point in time, like in her adolescence, it had been the one thing she could depend on, the one thing that could create a relief and a comfort, even if temporarily, so that it was the one way she knew she could be effective in relieving tension. And it became as hard to give up as a good friend because it had always been there when nobody and nothing else was. So the process itself had to be mourned. And to say goodbye to an old friend was difficult, even though very welcome, because it was a transformation of identity, because the emphasis that I had was you are not a bulimic in recovery. Bulimia was a way station to become more of your true self. So this is analogous to what we do in coaching of help someone recognize their fundamental identity of what they're always returning to, and any movement, change, transformation from that identity will require, you know, giving up a part of their identity of who they once were. And that's not easy because that's the identity is like a belief or like a fact, a part of the brain. It's an anatomical reality in the brain. So that becomes a necessary process. So that's where, as coaches, we can help someone in that process by simply reflecting on the process. You know, I hear you seeing yourself in a different way now as you're responding differently. So we highlight and reflect that, which in a way helps the client reflect on and internalize that process as their own. So with what you were thinking and reflecting on and hearing or reading that, does that fit with your experience?
It does. It makes a lot of sense. More, less so for me, but it's definitely a tie to, it's a tie to family members, right? There's the story is highly tied to like family members, and that's definitely part of that situation. And I really, the other thing that resonates is the smaller victories every day. I guess my question on that too is when you talk about creating a vision, being specific about it, if you don't know what that vision is going to be, how do you be specific and yet tie in sort of flexibility for when the story changes? Is the key to that making small choices and giving yourself, do you understand what I'm asking?
I think I do. Let me send, and I'm realizing now that it's not included in your workbook. Let me send to each of you a chapter on the neuroscience of a vision, which is a systematic way to create a vision as well as affirmations for working with a client. It's a short chapter, and I'll send it to you as an attachment, because when someone may be afraid of success or doesn't know what success may look like, they can create a vision of the successful attainment of something and then generate as part of that vision how they think and feel and experience and all the sensory experience of it. And every time they revisit that vision, that scenario of the successful completion, like once in the morning, once in the evening, they're hardwiring it in their brain so that it's something they're not going to feel a phobia about, because they've already created it. They just need to successively approximate getting there with a strategy, which is where we can come in.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I'll
Thank
send
you.
That. Also, a couple of you have mentioned some of the things that I've mentioned. I've done a number of white papers, and you've heard a little snippet of some of them in these four seminars, a series of white papers for coaches that I've specialty certified in peak performance, wellness, money story. And it's in a book now. It's 21 white papers, 21 chapters of different aspects from story, hope, memory, belief, a whole number of things that are relevant for coaches with Coaching Illustrated. I'll send a link to that. It's in paperback now, and I'll send a link to that so that if you look at it, see if it's of interest to you. There are 21 chapters with a single title.
Right.
It'll tell you what the chapter's about. So I'll send that to you along with the visualization chapter, which is not in that book. So thanks for that. Any other aspects of that might be helpful for us to talk about?
This is Bernita again. I just wanted to say thank you. It almost feels like, you know, it could go on and on, but as you put in step 7, number B, every transition has to begin with an ending. And I know this is the ending of this four-step series here. I think your final recap and the pieces about the story, I would often say the clients, you know, and colleagues, what I've learned over the years is that, you know, facts tell and stories sell. And to hear you kind of have summary of that, the way we communicate, how our stories are the most powerful way that we communicate the others.
Yes.
So just good to hear that the alignment is there. And definitely I want to make sure my generations behind me or coming up after me will have the story that I would like to have told. And so I'm going to work on making sure I get it right for myself as well as my clients. So thank you again.
That's great. And what we do and the model that we demonstrate moment by moment is one that our children and then ultimately our clients will download while we're talking about other things. So that's why we want to be sure that we understand our story and that we have, for example, a comfort about dealing with matters of money, because then we'll know clearly if there's a discomfort, it comes from the client, and we can clearly focus on that then and ultimately help the client. And this is why, for example, I recommend as you have a brief discussion, or some of you may have like a sample session at the end, to make a recommendation for your professional coaching services as any other professional would. You go to a doc, they don't say, well, you know, I've got this package of sour, what do you think about us working together? No, there's a clear recommendation of, based on that assessment, I would recommend that we work together in mentor coaching by establishing a standing time each week of 50 minutes by telephone, and I will send you a link, or I will send you a download, an attachment rather, of a client information packet to fill out before our first session, and that will also have the agreement in it. I'll send you a link for the monthly retainer to address before both of these before our first session. The retainer will cover all of the weekly sessions plus whatever materials, resources, and then email communication in between. My monthly retainer is whatever you decide it is. So you've done an assessment. You're making a recommendation for your professional services. It's clear, unambiguous. You're not asking, in my view, this is all one preference. You're not offering someone something that they don't know how to make an informed decision. Well, you want the 3-month or the 5-month package, you want to meet. No, you're making a recommendation. You don't go to a physician and he gives you 3 options. The physician makes a recommendation based on an assessment, and it's professional. Thoughts of what you guys want to talk about now? Other questions or things that you'd like to revisit or address that we didn't?
Have a question.
Go ahead, please.
Sorry again. If we had the ability, or if you have the ability, if there are questions that we may have post this class, maybe within the next 30 days, would we be able to communicate with you via email on that?
Yeah, fire off an email, and I'll address it if you have one. Also, while I'm speaking of, acting as a professional, and you're not in sales, you're not doing upsells, I will mention, since you mentioned about change and transition, the next seminar series that I'm doing beginning 1 week from tonight through CTA is about the neuroscience of change and transition that we help our clients with, the mind, brain, and performance sciences applied to change and transition. So you are welcome to look at that to see if it may be of interest to you to continue our discussions that way. So I apologize for upsell. I abhor that, but I did want to mention it since there was a note of that. So other things that we may not have discussed enough or that you still have a question about? Well, I appreciate very much all of the responses, kind words, the questions and goals that you sent in initially and that you've sent in subsequently as well. I hope this has been helpful to you. May have raised some other questions, but that's a way to keep inquiry going, and that's a way to not end inquiries, to keep it open, which is exactly what we do with clients, and what else? Or is there anything else that you think about? What's the opportunity here? That those are the kind of things that continue a discussion rather than close it off. So thank you very much, and I'll be eager to hear from you if you have something that comes up as you reflect on this that's not clear. Let me know, and I'll respond to it, and I'll send you guys a couple of things that I mentioned. So thanks very much for your participation. It's been a privilege of doing this with you, and I've learned too and appreciate your interaction and energy. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
Good night, all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Absolutely.